The Euphrates Institute envisions a world with less terrorism, conflict, and fear. Janessa Ganswilder is the group's founder and executive director. She's in St. Louis for a discussion tonight in Webster Groves. Welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And I just found out that you do have a St. Louis connection. You're not from here originally, but you lived here, what, more than a decade?
Mm-hmm. 11 years going to college here, and then I came back for 7 years to teach and live in the area. And so it feels like coming back home in a way.
Good. And you went to college in Illinois, in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. We consider ourselves part of the greater St. Louis area.
Well, yes, of course. you're on a mission, that's the way I put it anyway, that had its origins for you when you worked for the CIA. So tell me what you did for the CIA and how all that happened.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey from CIA counterterrorism, counterinsurgency analyst to peace builder. It's not your normal trajectory.
And what does an analyst do for the CIA?
Yeah, well, we piece together pieces of information and try to paint a picture for our policymakers of what's going on in X country. That's really the analyst's job. But I started in January of 2001, imagine 9 months before 9/11.
Wow.
And 9/11 happened in the middle of my training, and my life changed overnight from one of, oh, this sleepy account on X country, which I can't say, to all of a sudden Middle East. And I'd never been interested in the Middle East before. In fact, I actively ignored it and found it depressing and dark and hopeless.
Why?
Well, it seemed like people fighting for thousands of years over a bunch of sand. And there just was no hope and no inspiration, and I wanted nothing to do with it. But 9/11 changed all of that, and since then I've been completely Middle East focused.
Can you talk about that little transition period in more detail about how 9/11 changed it for you and just what you went through?
Yeah, well, I was working on a different part of the world, and after 9/11 happened, I was immediately transferred to a task force working on Afghanistan. So I did that from 2001 to 2003, but all the while wishing I could actually go to the country and meet the people and learn the language and smell the air. And I think so much of really understanding at a gut level what's happening in a country and analyzing it appropriately is being there on the ground. And I never got the chance to go. And so in 2003, they were then asking for volunteers to go to Iraq for 90 days. I thought, here's my chance to escape my cubicle and get out in the field and actually see for myself and experience what was going on. So my boss let me sign up 90 days. And of course, 90 days turned into a year and 9 months, almost 2 years.
How did fear play into all this? You know, when I was first reading about you and I read how you said how 9/11 changed everything, I just had a mental image of fear and terror on your part. I mean, is that what you felt?
Actually, in the field, you have to so be in the moment. There's no time to let yourself feel fear, honestly. I mean, you're just grateful every moment to be alive and to be breathing, and you are so mission-focused that when I experienced fear and terror is when I came home on break. And then I realized, oh my goodness, what have I just been living through? The terror would grip me. I'd shake. I would cry and think, I'm going to go back to that. I could die. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? But when you're there, it's just all about what you're accomplishing, the results, the mission, and there just was no time to feel anything.
Well, you founded the Euphrates Institute. That's after the CIA was behind you.
I resigned at the end of 2005, just after coming back from Iraq, and then immediately founded the Institute.
Well, why didn't you, just go live on a beach or take up painting?
I was so struck by the disconnect between what I had been living, breathing, sleeping, working, which was Middle East politics issues, the war on terror, and how relevant those were to every single American, from the gas we put in our cars to the birthplace of our religions to our security, the men we send off as soldiers to fight, the trillions of dollars we're spending, the terrorism as a result. And so all of this was happening. It was my entire world. And then when I came back home, not only did no one really care or understand, but they just didn't feel that it was relevant to their lives. There was just such an ignorance, lack of understanding, and a lack of engagement with those issues in that part of the world. And I thought, there's a real disconnect and a problem here. Americans, we're involved in these wars in this part of the world that so impacts all of us, and yet we don't know that we're involved and we don't care. We're not engaged in a way that's positive, in a way that's informative. And I thought that's not right. That's not going to get us where we need to go
and part of
solving
it,
these problems.
Didn't you pick up on a sort of prejudice against people in our part of the world, against people in that part of the world?
Absolutely. And I shared that prejudice. You know, heading over, my first job that first year was as a counterterrorism, counterinsurgency analyst. They were the enemy. The Iraqis were the enemy. And it was my job to paint a picture of this enemy, to understand why they were trying to kill us, where were they getting their funding. And so I really shared that view of they were out to get us and we needed to destroy them. And after I realized the impact that that had on me personally, that it felt like catching drops of water from a leaky faucet. Great, we get a bad guy, there's 10 more to fill his place. It was a never-ending fight, and I wanted to do something. Well, how do you stem that leaky faucet? How do you stop this war from starting? How do you stop terrorism at its source? And so then I switched jobs completely from counterterrorism to working with Iraqi political parties in advance of the democratic elections. All of a sudden, instead of interrogating Iraqis, I'm working side by side with them as partners. All of a sudden, they became human beings to me.
There's a little catchphrase that you use I'd like you to talk about. It's the other is a brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went from seeing Iraqis as the other, as foreign, as terrorists, as the enemy, to seeing them as brothers, to seeing them as partners, as human beings, as we can work together to achieve something. And that is so much not only more personally fulfilling and rewarding, but it's going to solve the problems and create the solutions that we actually need to see in the Middle East much more effectively.
This hasn't been an easy fight for you, has it? I mean, don't you get a lot of opposition to that view?
Of course. People, yeah. It's so much easier to just throw military might at a problem. You can see the results. You can, you know, show how many bad guys you've taken off the list. And yet, if it's not effective, we have to talk about, yes, let's keep our military. Let's have those forces in place. But let's also throw some money and support to building democracy on the ground, to building education, arts and culture, the things that stop these issues at their source.
I want to invite our audience, if they'd like to participate in this, maybe they have a comment or a question for you. They'd be more than welcome to join us today. You can call us at area code 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You mentioned and we're talking to Janessa Jans Wilder, the founder and CEO of the Euphrates Institute. And I think there are 22 chapters around the world.
Actually, we have 25 chapters.
And are you starting one in St. Louis?
Yes, they were just getting going, and they're the ones sponsoring the talk tonight.
So what good is a chapter in St. Louis, Missouri?
There's so much to do in St. Louis. There's mosques to visit and talks to hear about. Okay, well, let's understand Islam. What are the basic beliefs? Who are our community members that are right here in St. Louis that are the other? Maybe they're immigrants. Maybe they're refugees. Maybe they're Muslims. Maybe it's people of a different race or political party. The other can take so many different facets. And so engaging that and just being open to having an experience or encounter or learning more is incredibly powerful.
Well, what about this political climate today?
Yeah, I think that's the major thing we're seeing. When I was just on leading a Middle East trip last fall, and as our group was experiencing the divide between Israelis and Palestinians, they said, oh my goodness, this is happening right here at home. The divide between Republicans and Democrats, it's the same kinds of arguments coming up, that same inability to listen, that same demonization of the other side. They're all parallels.
Well, I mean, do you feel good about it? Are you frustrated about how people are reacting to things, or where are you coming from?
Oh, I see it as an opportunity that right here at home, there's peace building that's needed. There is the other that we need to turn into a brother. We have to learn how to be able to listen to a side that we don't agree with.
And if we don't?
Well, then more division, more polarization, more dysfunction in Washington, more ruptures between family members and community members that we're seeing in this heightened political climate. It's scary in a way.
You mentioned that you went to school at the Principia, and I think you wrote, I think it was recently, a piece in one of their publications about ISIS and Islamic extremism.
Yeah. let's see, that was a year ago. I was just trying to help people understand what were the roots of why people would be drawn to a group like ISIS. And in fact, I was talking to a class this morning and sharing, you know, if you're a young man and in your country, you have no economic prospects to speak of, you know, there's no good job, a viable job. It's hard to get married because it's so expensive. And then there's no dating in Islam. And so you're frustrated in all these ways. And here's a group promising you influence and power for the first time, guns, glory, and women. I mean, they even have sex slaves, for goodness sake. And then you're part of this epic battle. You're part of a bigger purpose than yourself, this end of times battle against the infidels of the West. You can see how alluring that would be to these disaffected, disenfranchised young men with a lot of energy and time on their hands. And so we're just talking about, it's not that it's just wacko barbarians. You know, what are the reasons that people would be drawn to this? And so once we understand the reasons, then you can go help to identify solutions to those.
There's sort of a parallel to that. Things will go along in, you know, poor urban areas, people feeling desperate, no options, and they do things
they
maybe they
gangs.
wouldn't do otherwise.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, right. Our number here is 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. If you have a question or a comment. And let's go to Coralis. I hope I pronounced the name right. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to just, this is a breath of fresh air. I'm a social worker. I work in community health. I'm an African-American woman. I'm a Christian. And we need this because divided, you know, we fall, you know, united, we stand. And we just need to hear more about programs like this that bring people together in the arts and what, you know, this is our future, our children, you know, and, you know, when you talk about arts, culture, you know, the infrastructure of education, all those things, that is what will hold a community get together, bring a community get together.
Beautiful.
Again, I work with a lot of immigrants and a lot of refugees, and, you know, people are people, and they bleed red, they suffer, they love, they have some of the same elements, you know, of family as we do, and it's just good to know about organizations like yourself and like yours, and just keep up the great work. I am very interested if you have an organization or an office opening here in St. Louis. I'm very interested in being part of it.
Thanks, Coralis. We appreciate that. And you will be talking tonight at the First Congregational Church of Webster Groves.
Yeah.
At 7:30 tonight, and she might be interested in going.
Coralis, please come, and I thank you for the work that you're doing in the community. And I just want to share one example of how arts has brought people together, even in war-torn Iraq. And it was a young woman who was on the show last fall. And at 17 years old, she started the National Youth Orchestra of Iraq, and she brought together Sunni and Shia, Kurdish and Christian, during the middle of the war. And these young people saw art, saw the orchestra as their lifeline. This was the only place they could express their humanity, be united with other Iraqis. They performed, you know, they learned how to speak each other's languages. They learned beautiful music together. They toured all over the Middle East and Europe. And so not only were they able to overcome divides and be united themselves, but they were that symbol of hope and inspiration around the world. And here's this young woman who just refused to say no and made her dream happen in a patriarchal society in the middle of the war. She'd lost both of her parents. And so if one person can accomplish that and give so much life and inspiration and hope to so many, and yet no one's heard of her. You know, everyone's heard of ISIS. No one's heard of Zuhal Sultan, the founder of this orchestra. But there are so many examples like that that I wish the media would portray more, that every American could help support and engage and share these stories. That's how we spread that hope and change, which is so important.
Jay from Normandy, you're on the air with Janessa Gans Wilder of the Euphrates Institute. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I possibly a little differently. I support what Trump's doing on immigration. I do actually support that. But on the Iraq War, I was vehemently against what Bush did by attacking Saddam Hussein and upsetting the apple cart. I'm just curious, did that throw the Middle East in total turmoil? What's your view on that? Was that, since you were there, What's your view on that? Do you agree that that really just blew the whole place up?
Yeah, thanks for your question. There was an Iraqi imam, I remember so vividly him telling me, Saddam Hussein was the radiator cap that kept these fractious contents together of Iraq, you know, the sectarian divisions, the ethnic divisions. And we came and removed the radiator cap and the contents exploded. And so, sure, you know, we came and in the midst of that, all of a sudden sectarianism became more of a conversation, became more of a role in the leadership. And so it did unleash a lot of that underlying issues that were going on. Of course, you know, a dictatorship really just represses those things. So those things have always been there in the region as undercurrents, and now they're all just coming to the surface. And so could it have been handled differently where, you know, let's deal with those tensions instead of unleashing them so abruptly and so violently? So, we have seen a lot of things in the aftermath. But I also had another Iraqi parliamentarian say, You'll see this planting of the seeds of democracy is going to have ripple effects throughout the region. And he pointed to the Arab Spring as evidence for that. Years later in our conversation, said, see, what you started in Iraq showed people the power of waving that purple finger and having cast their vote. And they want to stand up. They're tired of dictatorship. They're tired of repression. It's, as a human being, it's natural to want those freedoms and to demand them. And so there were massive uprisings. And unfortunately, what they've gotten as a result is even worse than before. It's just tragic for the people of that region who are yearning for change and yearning for a better situation.
Dennis from University City has a question, I think, about women in Afghanistan. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yes, ma'am. Are you familiar with Sarah Chase?
No, I'm not.
All right. She has written a book called The Thief of State. She lived in Kandahar and created the Argonne Cooperative.
Hmm.
And speaks Dari and Pashto. And she mentions the strength of the Taliban created by intergovernmental corruption. Not necessarily the president, but various people stealing from the workers, lots and lots of money, and not only there, of course, in Nigeria and in Iraq, helping to create ISIS. And then, are you familiar with The Blowback by Chalmers Johnson?
Yes. Yep, I have read that.
All right. And then the book, the two books, one of them about how Saudi Arabia is not our friend and how Iran is not really our enemy and why, written by a CIA agent.
Thanks, Dennis, for that. We do appreciate it. Let's move on because, you know, I think it's hard enough, Janessa, for adults to wrap their minds around this. What about young people and what they hear from society and what they read and they're forming their impressions? Jacob in St. Louis has some thoughts about that.
Mm.
Hi, Jacob. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say thanks. Such a refreshing conversation to have. But more or less, I just wanted to ask, I teach high school. And I found myself, you know, trying to tackle all of the complex issues that come along with getting, you know, 15 and 16 and 17, 18-year-old students to not only become interested in it, but to better understand it. I guess, simply put, what would be your biggest piece of advice as far as kind of fundamentally, if you could push one thing onto students, what would that be to better understand not only you know, currently, I guess, with our foreign policy or the refugee crisis, and I could go on and on, but what would be your biggest piece of advice for one thing for students to understand?
Yeah, it's simple. For high school and adults, there's got to be a human story or a human connection. And you can do that in your classroom so many ways. You can Skype someone in from the Middle East. You can show a film about, you know, documenting a refugee's experience or someone's life in Iraq. You can go visit the local mosque and have these kids actually meet Muslims. You've got to make it real and personal and something that they can touch and hear and experience, or else it'll just It'll just feel like a news report. It'll feel abstract and removed from their lives. As soon as they have an encounter, a personal encounter with a human being on the other side, and it's a real story to them, it changes everything.
Well, Janessa Ganswilder will be talking about this a lot more tonight. She's the founder and CEO of the Frates Institute. 7:30 this evening, she'll be speaking at the First Congregational Church of Webster Groves on Lockwood. And you can go to our website, of course, stlpublicradio.org, to find out more about that. And just finally, as we leave, do you see any positive signs that what you and the Frates Institute are trying to do will have an effect? I mean, how hopeful are you?
Yeah, it has an effect at the grassroots. So I see lives transformed and changed all the time, from chapters in Pakistan to all over the U.S. And so the theory of social change is that you mobilize that grassroots and you build public support, and then eventually it hits that tipping point. And the tipping point is somewhere between 5% and 20% of the population. So obviously we're not there yet. But as long as we're building that momentum and growth, the last thing that will be affected is Washington and politics, according to that theory.
We'll leave it there.
That's why I left Washington.
Maybe a good choice. Janessa Ganswilder, thank you so much for sharing today, and welcome back to St. Louis.
Thank you.
And I hope you have a wonderful event tonight. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.